I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick. You'll also hear John, KC2 WGB. You'll also hear Paul, WS2N. And quite often you'll also hear Hal, K6DPZ. That group of guys gathers and tries to organize this thing called the Technical Net, and we try to answer people's questions. Arguably the most educational hobby you can consider easily is ham radio. If you want to really understand how wireless equipment works, how antennas work, transmission lines, transmitters, receivers, repeaters, moon bounce, meteor scatter, and all these other, there's 26 different kinds of ham radio. And for the last 31 years, this group of guys in the New York City area, and now it branches out quite a bit further by way of Echolink and IRLP. Let me drop. This group of guys gather, and they educate each other. They teach each other how this equipment works. I'm convinced that the schools are doing a fairly poor job of teaching wireless engineering practices. They're not teaching it in a useful engineering form, in my opinion. They're stuck in the paradigm. They're stuck in the tradition. They've always done it this way since 1947, and why should they change? Seems to be the attitude. And so when I interview students that come straight out of school and they ask them which course they didn't enjoy very much, quite often it's the fields and waves course, the course that's supposed to teach them the basic information that allows them to do wireless and in particular antenna engineering. That's the course that a significant percentage of the students studying communications, particularly RF communications, wireless communication, that's the course they enjoyed the least. That should be the course they enjoy the most if it was properly presented. If Walter Lewin was doing that, this real good physics teacher from MIT, it wouldn't be done that way. So a change is required. I did a calculation this week. Let me drop. In answer to the question that Eric, KE2EJ, asked last week about impedance matching an antenna to the environment, I did some back-of-the-envelope calculations along those lines, and the answer surprised me. So after Paul, we'll go into some of those details. The usual menu that we've come up with, this TechNet is an evolving thing over the 31 years. It used to be a one-hour show. People complained there wasn't enough time to get their answers. It became 2, 3, and now it's 4 hours. We start at 8 o'clock. We usually end at midnight. The machine automatically gets turned off at midnight at my request, because without that, some of these extremely enthusiastic guys would go until the sun rises. And in the college I went to, we used to have a joke. Every time the sun rises, you're supposed to change your socks. And some of these guys are, you know, working around the clock, studying for a final exam or whatever. Let me drop. The menu we've come up with over all those years, and if you don't like the menu, you're allowed to make requests that we change it. We'll consider it, but enough people change it. But the menu is that the first hour, we take check-ins of only those people who have a question or a comment for the net. We take those check-ins in order. We try to give quasi-brief results, brief answers to their questions. That takes up the first hour or so, followed by John opening the mailbag of people who have sent him emails, snail mails, pigeon messages, and whatever. And this particular week, John has gotten 283 emails with reference to the Technical Net. That's an all-time high. So something is going on out there. There's a thirst for knowledge, is the impression I have. A thirst for RF knowledge. And I think that thirst is primarily being caused by the fact that the schools are very poorly teaching the subject. Let me drop. The questions during the first hour, John giving us the a few of the universal mailbag responses, the ones that we think have universal interest. We'll go through a few of those. Paul, WS2N, our space expert, will then tell us what National Aeronautics and Space Administration has been doing in the last week. And they're always doing some exciting things. After those three items, we then go into deeper subjects for the rest of the night. And there are some people who don't appreciate those deeper subjects. A lot of people do. Can't please everybody. But to be forewarned is to be forearmed. You know that deeper subject is going to take place. beyond, let me say, 10 o'clock or so. And if that displeases you, there are 800 channels on your 2-meter radio. You can go to one of the other 799 channels, or go to another band. This is something we've been doing now. This technical net began in September of 1982. Here we are 31 years downrange. Thank goodness a guy named Alan, KC2RFN, nominated the technical net for an award 3 years ago, and it received the Board of Directors ARRL Award for Technical Assistance for the year 2010. So we are getting some recognition. Alrighty, by way of the other interconnection techniques that Eric, KE2EJ, and others that run this machine have been creating over the years, we now have Echolink and IRLP, and there's also a chat room. There's all kinds of things that connect the TechNet to the rest of the world. We're getting socially connected, I guess. Alrighty, at this time I'm going to be taking check-ins for people who do have a question or a comment. You need not check in, say, because you're listening. After 31 years, we think people are listening. This is TechNet number 1471 of the series that began way back in September. A typical check-in would sound like this, W-H-U-R-Y-Y, Joe and Yes. So give me your check-ins right now, H-U-L-I-W listening.
H-2-M-M-Y, Ray, Yes.
W-H-U-R-Y-Y, Joe, Yes.
P-I-G, Don, Yes.
Okay, we're going to need some corrections now. The first one I heard was KC2MMY, Ray, Joe, W-H-U-R-Y-Y. I then heard G-I-G, Don. Now give me the prefix to that, Sean. Don, go ahead.
KD2DIG.
I think that's Kilo Delta 2, Golf India Golf. Okay, we got you, Don. Who is the other person checking in?
NY2HF, Dennis.
Okay, we got Dennis, our man from way out there in Kutchuk. One of the few guys you know who can almost completely remove himself from the grid. Alrighty, anyone else to check in? Give me your call letters and name right now.
WS2N, Paul with the space report. Good evening, John. Good evening, Dick.
KDPZ, checking in for anybody who wants to get quick answers to their dissertations.
Very fine, now Paul and Hal. And at Hal's request, we're going to ask each person, as they give us their question, they have the option of asking for the brief answer or the more complete answer. It's your choice. KC2MMY, Ray, go right ahead. K2RAW in the TechNet.
Okay, good evening, Dick, and everyone in the TechNet. And I like the long answers. Personally, for me. And I guess my question is, I'm playing around with this 2-meter single sideband, and I seem to be able to get so much further with single sideband, and I was wondering why that is. I mean, I'm getting stations with 2 watts all the way in Hartford, Connecticut from Yonkers, and they can hear me fine. And on Simplex FM, I'm lucky if I can get to, Gabe's house there, which is only 2-4 miles away. So what is the big secret there with the single sideband? What's going on, if you could tell me? Thank you.
Believe it or not, that was one of the subjects I studied in the college I went to. I think that was a senior project, to compare single sideband to AM and FM, the angular modulations, the amplitude modulations, and sideband. Depending on who you talk to, single sideband has somewhere between a 6 and a 9 decibel advantage over FM. And why is that? In the case of FM, the main thing you transmit is the carrier. If you looked on the spectrum analyzer, you would see a great big signal in the middle that represents the carrier. And when you start modulating, when you start talking into the microphone, a little bit of that energy of the carrier gets smeared into the upper and lower sideband. If I whistled into the microphone at a 1 kilohertz rate, and I look at a spectrum analyzer, I would see a signal 1 kilohertz higher than the carrier, and a signal 1 kilohertz lower than the carrier would be the main signals you see with narrowband FM. There'd be a couple of other 2 kilohertz and 3 kilohertz display signals, but in the case of narrowband F, the majority of it is in those primary sidebands. And those sidebands rarely have more than about 30% of the energy of the carrier if I choose the just the right amplitude and just the right tone that I whistle into the microphone. So most of the energy is in the carrier, and something like 30% of the energy is in the sideband. In the case of amplitude modulation, the ratio gets a little bit better, but not very much. Let me drop. And once you study what's going on with a spectrum analyzer, you realize that the sideband contains the useful information. The carrier conveys no information, other than the fact that you turned on a transmitter. You turn on a Morse code transmitter, and you press down the key, and you put a brick on it. The only information you're transmitting to the world is, yes, Mike, your transmitter is on the air. But other real information is not going there. So you soon realize the sideband is where the information is. That's where the voice, the data, whatever. So by way of the fancy techniques invented by, Papenfuss was one of the guys who wrote a significant book on the subject, you soon realize that with the right kind of electronics, you can design a transmitter in such a way that every bit of the power you transmit is in one single sideband. It's all information and nothing else. And the carrier that's required in order to do the proper demodulation, that's supplied by the receiver in the case of a single sideband setup. So the carrier you have to re-inject in order to convert that sideband into audio and then in envelope detected, that's all done by your so-called product detector, and the product detector is reinserting the missing carrier that you didn't bother transmitting with sideband. So sideband has this advantage. Everything you're transmitting is information. If you're not talking, nothing comes out of the transmitter. You're not transmitting any power. You're not wasting any power from the power supply. So it's power efficient, spectrum efficient. It takes up less than half the width. So you can squeeze a whole lot of signals in there. And another funny thing that happens with sideband, let me drop, is that it's extremely tolerant of crowded conditions. You can put two or three sideband signals almost on top of each other. And you listen carefully with a well-tuned sideband receiver, and you will hear the individual audios. You try doing that with AM or FM, you put multiple signals very close together, and you hear a bunch of squealing sounds, the heterodynes, of those signals beating against each other. Sideband doesn't do that. So, and the sideband that we amateurs transmit to each other, because it uses a lot of speech processing in order to try to increase the efficiency, some of us have got rigs that are a little bit less than ideal in third harmonic distortion. It's not a completely linear process. We've all gotten used to sideband, and you walk into a ham shack. You walk into the first ham shack, and the guy is listening to sideband. You walk into the second ham shack, and the guy is listening to FM. Without even asking any questions, without looking at the dials, your ears will tell you immediately that the first guy is using sideband and the second guy is using FM. Sideband's got a very characteristic set of distortions and characteristics that you'll recognize immediately if you're a ham radio operator listening to sideband. Let me drop. It doesn't have to be that way. It's probably that way for a couple of good reasons when we do it, we hams. But you may not know it that the 20 and 30 years ago, every single signal that you heard over the telephone was single sideband. That's the way Ma Bell did it. It's the way they squeezed all of those signals onto that twisted pair into the long range of the long distance contacts were all single sideband. If the local oscillator you inject is sufficiently accurate in frequency, amplitude, and phase by way of a pilot signal that you sent, along, it had nearly perfect fidelity, and that's the way sideband can be done. And so it's hard to believe that that was sideband. So as you study that a little bit more, Ray, you'll find out that it has these advantages, and therefore a guy with a good 2-meter Yagi on his roof of his house, if he happens to have a high location, if he happens to have a low noise preamplifier added, many of the rigs we buy are kind of dead in the front end. You add a preamplifier where you can listen to really weak signals. A guy with a 100-watt amplifier, solid state, and a single Yagi on the roof of the house can easily, in the New York area, most of the time, talk to the surrounding states, New York, New Jersey, Connecticut. Most of the time talk to Maryland and Delaware. Quite frequently talk to Virginia. When you aim up to the north, you'll be talking to Massachusetts, Rhode Island, quite often New Hampshire and Vermont, once in a while into Maine, out to Pennsylvania, occasionally out to Ohio. Quite often you'll talk those kind of ranges with 100 watts and a good Yagi, not too high in the...
Repeater, time out.
As I said, not too high in the air. Those kind of ranges are possible with single sideband. And FM has got a very small fraction of that. There's a kind of non-linearity that occurs with an FM signal. The FM signal, when it's above threshold and it's strong enough, it's got some beautiful fidelity. That's the strong news. But it's got a very nasty threshold characteristic. As you start getting down to about 5 decibels of carrier-to-noise ratio on an FM receiver, all of a sudden it goes into kind of a crashing phenomenon where a little bit of weakening of the signal and all of a sudden you start hearing a whole lot of noise. In fact, we measure the threshold of an FM receiver by finding out what amount of signal going into the receiver gives you 20 decibels of quieting of the noise the discriminator gives you when it doesn't see a carrier. So this is some of the story. It's a darn good subject to study, Ray, and there are all kinds of ways of making a hell of a lot more fidelity and a lot more usefulness of your sideband transmitters. There's ways you can improve the audio quality if you so desire. That's some of the story, Ray. KC2MMY, a good question. KQLIW in the TechNet. DPZ with some fast comments. Go right ahead there, Hal. And I must have left out a whole lot of things. You got it now. Thank you, Dick. Yeah, number one, if you use sideband instead of FM mobile, your duty cycle of sidebands are 30% compared to using FM. And with some of the new solid-state radios that work sideband, you can do very well mobile simplex. There aren't really any sideband translators up that much here on the East Coast as far as repeaters go, but you can work 3 times longer talking simplex on sideband, even the mobile, if you have some of the newer rigs like the 706 and FT100 and some of the other ones that are...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Very fine, Hal. I'm going to add one other comment. When I was working at the Rome Air Development Center 15 years ago, and I had to go there every single weekend, I would travel with my automobile, my station wagon. I had a 180-watt Mirage amplifier. I was putting out sideband into a very simple pair of antennas on the roof of the car. One of them was a square loop antenna, and the other one was a 5/8 wave mag mount. And by way of a relay I had in the passenger compartment, I could flip back and forth between the two. So in other words, I could transmit sideband vertically polarized or horizontally polarized. And I was talking to Mr. Pillsbury in southern New Jersey, all the way up to, on the New York Thruway, up to Albany, out on Route 90, all the way over to Utica. I was talking 200 miles, single sideband, from my automobile to Russ Pillsbury in southern New Jersey. And I was doing that almost every weekend. Let me drop. Now, there's a little bit of a catch here. I'll admit that Russ Pillsbury was using 100 feet of tower with 4 Yagis on top of it on 2 meters. It was a moon-bounce antenna. So the big gun that made this all work was on his end. But it gives you some idea of what sideband can do. 200 miles range to my low-altitude automobile while I'm driving up to Utica, and we had 90% QSO, 90% copy in both directions during almost all of that that path. And when I flipped back and forth between horizontal and vertical, even though he was running horizontal, there was no difference when I was down in the valleys of the New York Thruway. When I got up to the hilltops, the scenic overlooks, where there was a much more direct path, then yes, the horizontal worked a lot better than the vertical because he was transmitting horizontal. But when I was down at road level, so to speak, that signal was being scattered through all of those trees and buildings and water towers and everything else. There was no polarization left. And I tried to, on a number of occasions, try to figure out how in the world did that signal get through all of that stuff. If you took an aircraft picture of that path that I was transmitting 200 miles from my very low-altitude automobile over to him, how in in the world did that signal get there? Let me drop. To me, it's proof positive of that philosophy you've heard me say an awful lot of times. You transmit a radio signal. It goes to every cubic centimeter of this universe. And I'm not kidding. The only thing left to discuss is how much attenuation did it experience going beyond that hill, through that tree, and whatever. Is the signal above the threshold of the equipment that you're using for that particular kind of transmission? But it goes everywhere. It may get super weak, but you listen to a really weak signal, like the Voyager spacecraft, 12 billion miles away, I think is the range right now. It's outside of the solar system. And that little 20-watt transmitter, QRP transmitter, is transmitting all of that distance back, and that signal doesn't get tired. That's kind of amazing to me. KC2MMY, K2RIW. Keep studying radio, Ray. There's a lot more to it.
Okay, Dick, thank you for the answer. Much better understanding. I just, if I can, a quick add-on just to double-check myself. I understand that the power goes into the sideband, which is mostly information, which is a major difference from the FM, but is the fact that you can inject the carrier at your end, because we're dismissing it when we transmit, does that allow you to recover a very weak signal? In other words, the signal's very weak, and the fact that you can inject your carrier back in, is that what allows for you to pick up a very, very weak signal? And then I'll let you go. Thanks.
You've made a very good guess, Ray, and you're right on. That's one of the major factors. Because you're re-injecting the carrier locally, and the threshold detector, your actual detector inside the receiver, doesn't have to put up with noise, so to speak. And therefore, the system of detection is almost perfectly linear. If you had some kind of a laboratory test equipment where you're generating a single sideband signal, somebody's voice, and you're slowly making the signal weaker and weaker and weaker. Every time you half the power of the signal, what you hear out of the loudspeaker of the audio will go down 3 dB, a thoroughly linear process. You try doing the exact same thing with FM. And as you start getting close to the noise level, all of a sudden, the noise coming out of the discriminator limiter system of an FM receiver, the noise starts jumping up real fast. It's got a nasty threshold crashing effect, FM. And sideband doesn't do that. It stays linear all the way down. And with the right kind of computer processing, there are ways you can suck that signal out of the noise. And so sideband is the way. It takes a little bit of extra effort to design the circuits to do it. Nowadays, with modern integrated circuits, that part becomes pretty easy. So there's more to the story, but you've got a good piece of it, in my opinion, Ray. As I said before, darn good question. The next guy who asked a question was Joe, WA2RYY. Let's make sure we wait long enough to reset everything. A couple of seconds beyond the beep. And you got it, Joe. K2RIW in the tech net.
GB with a quickie.
Yeah, stand by a minute, Joe. Go ahead, John.
Dick, put Wesley down post-pole space report, please. He requested that earlier.
Roger, Dodger. He's there. Joe, you got it.
Okay, thank you, Dick. To meet you, YY. The subject I'd like to discuss or throw into the tech net is about transmitter intermodulation. You can pick it up as far as that subject, and I'll give you a specific example of it as it progresses. Back to you.
One of the nice advantages of FM is that the final stage of the transmitter can run Class C. And a Class C final stage in efficiency of generating RF from B+ can be 70%, and with some of the modern techniques of Class of C, D, E, F, G, and so on, there's some very fancy computer-like switching techniques that can be applied to a final stage. So the final stage of your FM transmitter can be running very nonlinear RF-wise. Very high in efficiency. That's the good news. The bad news is that the receiver doesn't have anywhere near the threshold characteristics you would like. The bad news about single sideband is to create really clean single sideband, like Ma Bell did with the telephone system 15, 20 years ago, requires extreme linearity. By linearity, I mean for every microvolt or volt or millivolt that you put into a stage of amplification, if the amplification has a 10-to-1 ratio, and for every millivolt you put in, you want to get exactly 10 millivolts out. And for every volt you put in, you want to get exactly 10 volts out with a stage that's got a 10-to-1 gain voltage-wise. That would be 20 dB of power gain, by the way. Let me drop. By conventional techniques, the process by which you create that linearity requires some pretty heroic procedures. One brute force technique is you design a 100-watt amplifier, but use it at the 10-watt level. You do that correctly and you'll get a lot of linearity. That's the good news. You'll get 5% DC to RF efficiency if you do that. So you pay a heavy price. You're using a great big power supply, a great big tube, and you're using very little of the power output. You start driving the tube further and further into its maximum power output, and it starts curving over into non-linearity. The way you measure that non-linearity is called third-order intermodulation distortion. It's one of the key techniques. And the way you do that, let me drop, is you don't put just one signal into the stage being tested. You put two separate signals. In the case of audio testing of a single sideband transmitter, you might put in two individual tones of, let me pick a number, an 800 hertz tone and a 1200 hertz tone. You put those two tones in simultaneously of equal amplitude, and if the whole system is thoroughly linear, when you look at what comes out of that receiver on a spectrum analyzer, you'll see nothing but those two tones. The slightest amount of non-linearity will start making mixtures of those tones. The second harmonic of one mixed with the fundamental of the other. And that gives you, because it's a 2x1 product, 2 plus 1 is 3, part of the reason why they call it third-order intermodulation distortion. There's a whole lot of fancy mathematics that goes into that, but the spectrum analyzer will show you other components, and those other components, when quantified, tells you the degree of non-linearity. And as your sideband transmitter has less and less linearity to it, there's at least two or three disadvantages you'll come into. Let me drop. One of them is that the audio will start sounding flat-topped and square-waved, crossover distortion. The audio will not sound quite as good as it should. The third order and fifth order intermodulation distortion means that your signal is now starting to occupy more space than your particular channel, so to speak. So you're in a contest operation, and the guy that's a couple of kc up the band starts hearing your splatter. He calls it splatter. As you start talking loudly, he starts hearing Donald Duck sounds coming out of his receiver caused by your non-linearity of your transmitter, even though his receiver maybe is not being overloaded. So being too wide in signal, being too distorted in signal, these are some of the disadvantages. And when it comes to getting single sideband through these very long ranges, if you can make the sideband extremely linear, and so that the flat tops do not get rounded off, if the spikes in the speech are coming through, then that signal can be extremely weak. When I was doing those long-range communications, let me drop. Way back in 1978-79, I had just invented, I'm using that word carefully, invented, so to speak, these 19-element insulated Yagis for 432. And I was so enthusiastic, I put up 16 of them. 16 Yagis at 432, all 19 elements long, 304 elements altogether. This great big antenna, which was 16 feet wide, 15 feet high, 13 feet deep, was all sitting on the top of my room number 6 tower, 100 feet above the ground. I had to build that antenna at the 100-foot level as a way of getting it past the guy wires. But once that antenna, with 29 dB of gain, was aimed down the East Coast, I could talk to K4CAW, Greensboro, North Carolina, 480 miles away on single sideband. And I did that every Tuesday night, summer, winter, spring, and fall for 4.5 years. We just couldn't believe that kind of range could be had. I mean, I'm on 300-foot high land, 100-foot high tower. My radio horizon is 40 miles away. He is 480 miles away, 200 miles inland. It wasn't even near the coast, if you know what I mean. Let me drop. And so I'm talking to a guy 10 times beyond my radio horizon. How in the world was that signal getting there? Forward propagated tropospheric scatter. Some of the signal was scattering off of aircraft. All kinds of ways that signal was getting there. If the single sideband had enough linearity, I could tolerate a signal that was giving me 1 or 2 dB above the noise, and because we understood each other's vocabulary, we were getting 90% copy under those conditions. And in the summertime, the signals got very strong on certain peaks of propagation characteristics, but the reliability in the summer, the summer had higher peaks but lower valleys of the QSB, if you know what I mean. The most reliable signals were in the wintertime, sometimes during a snowstorm. So when it comes to really long-range, weak signal work with single sideband, there's a lot of fun you can have with that one. That array I put up was intended for moonbounds. I was having so much fun talking to people within a 480-mile radius and picking their brain. I was having so much fun talking to people. I talked to about 500 different hands. I was having so much fun doing that, I never got around to adding the elevation control to really start doing any moonbounds on that antenna. So I know I've got a little bit off the linearity subject, but there's a lot to be gained in spending some time making sure you've got clean audio and high linearity of a single sideband transmitter. W-A-Q-L-Y-Y, K-2-L-I-W in the TechNet. You've got it, Joe.
Okay. Now, do you want the specific example?
You've succeeded in triggering my curiosity, Joe. Go right ahead.
Okay, where this question is going is like this. I just recently was given this information. I didn't know about this, but this has to do with a couple of commercial transmitters. But it's a subject that it can have something to do with amateur transmitters anyway in high buildings and close proximity to each other. NOAA Weather operates on 162.55 megahertz. They're apparently, and they can run as high, apparently, if I understand to say now, they can run transmitters as high as about 1,000 watts output. I didn't know they ran that kind of power level. They are apparently capable of running transmitters about as high. So say they do run a transmitter as high as 1,000 watts, that's plus 60 dBm. Okay, that's pretty good. They had another transmitter on the air, come on the air from some other source. I don't know who it is, but it produced intermod on the Coast Channel 16 frequency. The other frequency was 168.3 megahertz. So when that transmitter was on the air, no weather was on the air, it produced an intermod hit that you could receive on the air at 156.8. So now you know the three frequencies. Now once you have that information, now I'll ask my question related to this.
I've got those numbers, Joe, so go right ahead.
Okay. It looks like NOAA Weather's frequency times 2 minus 168.3 equals 156.8, okay? So it's something like that as far as mathematical process, how the mathematical process goes. My question is, if the two transmitters were very, very closely co-located, and typically on a rooftop location, you can decouple between the antennas, but still there's some energy loss between even two frequencies in band that I've seen in real life, real-time measurements of something like about 30 dB, maybe 40 dB between the antennas. I don't think it's usually too much stronger than that between one antenna to another. Say if you had that kind of signal level come down the other guy's antenna. When that energy is radiated back into the PA of the first transmitter, say, call it no weather, and say it's 30 dB down from what their carrier power actually is, say they're running a 100-watt transmitter. When this arrives in the PA itself, is this re-radiated on the third frequency on the 156? Is this re-radiated in a linear function and right back out on the air through a mixing process, or is it somewhere to calculate that, or how does that actually work as far as measurements on the air? And what I'm trying to understand is, through the mixing process now with the money is produced, is it truly kept in a linear function, where the signal coming in is, say, 30 dB down, it's mixing with a transmitter that has a power of, you know, plus 60 dBm. Theoretically, what would you say your intermod product would be on Win56.8? Back to you.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Richard, I just have a fast comment if you want.
Fire away, Hal.
Okay, there may be just a high power transmitter putting out on 5.75, and you're getting a mix that's coming right back. You may not even have a total intermod, just a mix problem.
As I see it, his two main signals, 162.55 and 168.3, are very close to 6 megacycles apart. The offended signal, 156.8, is very close to 6 megacycles below the lowest of the two main signals. So the spacing is just right. Whenever you've got two signals that are, let's say, 6 megacycles apart, you're going to be making other products 6 megacycles below the lowest and 6 megacycles above the highest when any non-linearity exists. Now, what can create that non-linearity? There's a slim possibility that some second harmonic and whatever is located 30, 40, 50, 60 dB down in the individual transmitters. Slim possibility of that. If they've done a good job and had a bandpass filter on that transmitter, that should not be happening. But there's a much bigger factor, let me tell you. You take, for instance, the Glen Oaks building, the North Shore Towers, where you've got a whole lot of antennas all on one roof, for instance. That is an environment that's really rich for making intermods in a very subtle manner. At first you'd say, well, a rusty bolt somewhere on a tower is picking up the two signals, and the nonlinearity of the rusty bolt is making some intermod. Yeah, that's possible. The most nonlinear thing on this planet is a transmitter. When you use it backwards, you can make a transmitter as linear as all hell when you're feeding it in the forward manner. You've carefully adjusted all the circuits, the impedances, and everything else, and you feed a signal and two signals or three signals through a transmitter, and if you've done a good job in the forward manner, it can be linear. But on the roof of closely packed transmitters on all on one roof, any of the signal coming out of antenna A going into antenna B, which is another transmitter, and that signal crawls down that line into the back end of that transmitter, it experiences an extremely strong nonlinearity when you feed an amplifier backwards. You think an amplifier is linear because in the forward manner it is. You feed it backwards, it's not. It is a beautiful mixer. So milliwatts of signal being fed into an adjacent transmitter's antenna can give you this grief. And for that reason, when you've got a lot of closely packed transmitters on a roof like that, every single one of those transmitters, which have a high quality circulator, isolator on the output of each transmitter. Let me drop.
I was just going to say that.
And boy, do I have a story for you later, Eric. Yeah, every one of them requires a very high quality circulator. A circulator is a ferrite-like device with a biasing magnetic field inside. It performs magic. It allows the signal to flow from the transmitter to the antenna. Any signal that tries to flow backwards through that circulator goes into a terminating load. It never gets to the transmitter. So every single one of those transmitters on a closely packed roof must have a high-quality circulator that covers at least well beyond the frequency region of that particular transmitter. What frequently happens is that some particular guy, a service person, has been assigned to fix transmitter number 4 on that roof. And the complaint was, well, it doesn't have quite the range it used to have. And the guy measures the power output. It's supposed to be 50 watts, and he's getting 45 watts. And he studies and looks for bad cables and bad connectors and whatever. And he does an experiment. He eliminates the circulator that had half a dB of loss, and all of a sudden he's up to spec. He's got to produce 50 watts of power. He was only producing 45. He takes out the circulator. He's got 51 watts. He says, aha, I've solved the problem. He takes out the circulator, puts it in his pocket, and walks away. And he has just created havoc. Every damn one of those transmitters on that roof are now pouring their signal into that transmitter, and all possible harmonics of those signals going into that final stage of the transmitter are being created right there. He eliminated the one little component. Every single transmitter on that roof has got to have a circulator or else you're all going to suffer. Eric, you've been down that road. I bet you've seen some of this grief. Give us a few words on this one. KE2EJ, K2LAW in the TechNet.
Yeah, I was just going to say exactly what you said. If you should pull a circulator out, you're just in trouble. There are circulators that are improperly adjusted, and even though you have the circulator there, some people don't quite understand how to set them up properly. So you can get into big trouble that way too. In a crowded roof like that, outfit. An absolute requirement, and all the operators of the equipment must, in order to be on that roof, have a circulator installed. And not only do you have a circulator, you usually have a bandpass filter to go with it, so it helps a lot. KYWK2J.
And you may have done such a good job of designing your transmitter that you think that, gee, I don't have to eliminate the second harmonic, third harmonic, and whatever. I don't need a fancy bandpass filter after my transmitter. I've solved all of that in the driver and the linearity of the final stage. You may think that is true. And your transmitter route, let me pick a number, 162.55 megs. And if you did put a bandpass filter, it would be 162.55 with plus or minus a few kilohertz, so to speak, would be the bandpass filter if you did a real good job. And you think, hey, my transmitter's not making any second and third harmonics. I don't need that.
Yeah.
What happens about the signals that are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 10 megacycles away that are crawling down your antenna, your feed line, and going into the back end of that transmitter? And it is the world's best mixer. It's going to make every possible harmonic. If you've got a good enough bandpass filter, the signals that are far enough away, the circulator sucks up some of them, and what's left over, the filter will reject it, so it doesn't get a chance to get down to that transmitter. Any signal fed backwards to a transmitter is going to give you grief when it comes to weak signal reception of adjacent sensitive receivers. The transmitter itself won't even know the difference that you're pumping power back in. It only takes milliwatts to do it. And when everybody is closely packed like you are on that roof, everybody's got a significant amount of power from every transmitter into every other antenna, into every other transmitter. So those circulators and high-quality circulators properly aligned and properly operating are required in order for that environment to be compatible with each other. With modern technology, let me drop this.
QG's in.
Low recognized, going to get you in a minute. With properly designed bandpass filters, and there's a whole class of filters called constant impedance bandpass filters, where they don't present a short circuit at the rejecting frequency. They reject those frequencies by sucking it up into a dummy load. So there's a whole class of really fancy filters, really fancy circulators that can help a lot. With modern technology, you can pile a whole lot of transmitters. Air Force One has a whole lot of transmitters on that airplane, all operating compatibly with each other. There are techniques by which you can put on the bumper of a Jeep four or five whip antennas, all running high power, and all those transmitters and receivers are running simultaneously, and each one doesn't know the other one is there. You use modern signal nulling techniques, active and passive. You'd be amazed what you can get away with. And Bill, you've seen a lot of intermods in your world of cellular telephone technology, and boy, I bet you you've seen intermods that at times are pretty difficult to explain, and yet with proper filtering and circulating and antenna adjusting, a lot of that can be eliminated most of the time. WB2QGZ, K2RIW, give us some of the words that you run through, Bill.
Well, typically we test for usual return loss, so whether it's DTF sweep and the Enervon test or anything we build. Because I make my own 2A minus B right in my mix when I diplex, so if everything isn't built to really exacting professional quality standards, we'll have a problem that we have to go back and fix later. And sometimes it's not fixable if it's an external sort of PIM. In other words, if I'm up in some church or some building with a clock tower and I've got a whole bunch of nickel-plated something or other, or nickel with something plated on top of it, up in front of the antenna and a clock movement or something, we're kind of doomed. But the one thing I wanted to bring up is typically, and I'm sure it has to do with how the phases all line up in the ports of the circulator and how stuff is in phase in the respective ports as it moves around or something. But circulators I've found generally make a bunch of second harmonic energy, so they usually need to be filled. They emphasize that second harmonic energy, it seems, and they typically need to be followed by a low pass in order to take that that stuff out, which can be troublesome somewhere else to another unprotected transmitter or rusty bolt or whatever. Back to that.
Yeah, when it comes to designing that circulator, if you know it's going to be on a 50-watt transmitter, you better design that circulator for the 100-watt category, so to speak. It's going to be physically larger in order to make sure it's not creating non-linearities. But when it comes to what looks like intermodulation distortion, but it's got an entirely different name, PIM, passive intermodulation distortion. PIM is something that if you Google those words and studying it, it's a little bit technical, but the current standard for a cell phone system, the antenna, the passive components, the cable going to the antenna, the jumpers, and those connectors, must pass a PIM test of minus 150 decibels. Ordinarily, when you and I are aligning a ham radio transmitter, we want the third order intermods to be 30 decibels down or greater, and we're happy. A real good quality commercial transmitter, maybe all the intermods are 60 decibels down. In the case of a cell phone system, you want the intermods to be 150 decibels suppressed. You'd be amazed what kind of fancy instrumentation is required to even measure that. And if your particular cell phone antenna system didn't meet the 150 dB passive intermodulation suppression number, if it gave you 130 instead of 150, you're going to be dropping cell calls. And your customers are going to be complaining, and you're going to be running into the revolving door problem. People are going to be going to other vendors because they're not happy with the way the cell phone works in that particular community. Let me drop.
Churn.
Yep, that's one of the words used for it. So a churn. So if you want to avoid the churn. Now, in the case of passive intermodulation, you can have the tiniest bit of dirt that your eye cannot even see that was on the fingers that are on the connector that you're putting together. This beautiful weatherproof connector, which is, you know, some of these connectors are $50 a piece, and because of slightly different dissimilar metals or whatever, the very minor microscopic etching process that goes on in that connector when a pair of 20-watt signals are going through it, with a certain number of megacycles of separation, it will be generating intermods, and those intermods better be 150 dB down. An extremely, tough specification. But cell phone systems have to do that. So there's a lot more to this than first meets the eye, as you can tell, Joe. You've only got a little bit of the top of the story, if you know what I mean. There's a lot more to it. To be A2RYY, K2RYW in the TechNet.
Okay, you still didn't answer the question I asked with this thing originally related to this thing. If you had a signal coming down your transmitter cable, and say somebody did not have a circulator or bandpass filter on their transmitter, and I've heard of that story too about people taking a cavity off a paging transmitter to get the extra dB out on the air and causing all sorts of havoc, radiating other things on the frequencies that they don't belong doing. But that's just the way the commercial game goes. I understand that. But I'm talking about from a technical standpoint. If a signal is coming down at a certain level, is it mixed and re-radiated back out on the offending frequency in a linear process? Is that's what I was asking you as a question?
I probably only have a partial answer for this one, Joe, but I'm going to try to make an example. Assume that the transmitter you're talking about right now, this 162.55 1 kilowatt transmitter, is, let me pick a number, 10 feet away from some other transmitter, and the other transmitter is running 50 watts. And so the amount of power from the 50-watt transmitter getting into the 1-kilowatt antenna is, let me pick a number, 30 dBm. Plus 30 dBm is 1 watt. So 1 watt of signal is getting there. And it curls down that cable and goes into that final stage of that transmitter. The transmitter, under some conditions, will make a mixed product that only has 6, 8, 10 dB of loss. A plus 30 dBm signal going in might come out as a plus 24 dBm signal on those undesired frequencies. There are cases in which the conversion loss, so to speak, the mixing conversion loss of that final stage of the transmitter might only be 6 or 8 dB down from the level of the signal that you put in. And now it is generating that other signal, that a phony signal that you don't want, which is jamming the daylights out of your sensitive receiver that's 10 feet away. So it is being generated in the final stage of the transmitter itself, whether it be a transistor or a tube, doesn't matter. You feed a transmitter backwards, and it is the world's best mixer. That's some of the answer I think you're looking for, Joe. W2LYY, K2LIW.
Yes, it is. I've heard that technical term before, conversion loss. So you're saying it's basically 6 dB down. Does that figure have anything to do with the primary power of the primary transmitter? Say if the primary transmitter is running 1,000 watts or plus 60 dBm, does that power level come into the equation or not?
I think the answer is it does not. In the worst case, if that plus 30 dBm signal comes down that antenna in the reverse direction, hits that transmitter, whether that transmitter is running 50 watts or 500 watts doesn't matter. In theory, its conversion loss to the undesired frequency could be almost equal, simply because of the way a transmitter behaves backwards. It's a kind of a square wave generator, so to speak. The system can be beautiful linear for a signal flowing in the forward direction through the final stage of that transmitter. But flowing backwards, it's the world's most nonlinear thing. And 6 dB is a little bit severe. Probably 8 dB is more likely. But if you made a careful measurement and you found an 8 dB loss in the conversion loss of the final stage of that transmitter, whether it be a 50 watt or a 500 watt, if you made that measurement and you gave me that number, I would say, yeah, that's close to what I've heard before. It's not unusual. Over to you, Joe, K2LAW.
Okay, I don't know the specifics as far as, you know, how strong the signal, the affected signal, was being radiated on the air. It was being picked up into a satellite receiver located on the same building someplace. I don't know that information. I'm just trying to, you know, just basically understand how this thing works. But what you said, it's very helpful information in trying to understand things. Can you start measuring signal levels, knowing something as far as, you know, the power level from transmitter A, the power level from the offending transmitter B, you might have some sort of guess as what the offending C frequency power level might be expected to be radiated out of that, the primary transmitter's antenna system. Back to you, Dick.
One more complicating situation here, Joe, is that the signal being fed back into that transmitter where it generates undesired signals that are only 6 or 8 dB down. That's true when the transmitter is transmitting. If that transmitter goes off the air, that conversion process essentially collapses. It goes away. So Murphy's Law dictates that you've got all your fancy instrumentation up on the roof of the building looking for the source of signal. Murphy's Law dictates that the offending transmitter will be off the air at the time that you're there, and you won't be able to find it. It'll drive you up a wall. So at random times, you'll get this crazy signal that's driving you up the wall, and it's not there all the time. It takes a certain combination of transmitters to be on simultaneously to get the problem. That's the way it often happens. And so finding it can be quite difficult, quite frustrating. It's a good thing you're tough, Joe. It's going to take a while. The next guy who asked us a question was Don. Kilo Delta 2, Golf India Golf. What would you like to talk about tonight, Don? K2RAW in the TechNet. My name is Dick.
Okay, Dick. Thank you. It's Delta India Golf also, by the way. I'd like the long answer, but please keep in mind I'm a new ham, and with the exception of what I learned in the last 8 or 9 months, I have very little electronics background. I'm moving forward with an antenna project. that I was sort of on the fence about, but you re-inspired me last week by listening to you basically said, I believe the paraphrase, if you can make it resonate, it will radiate. Anyway, I'm putting about 200 feet of wire in a horizontal loop. It's going to terminate roughly 12 to 16 feet off the ground, being fed with 450-ohm ladder line. My question, it's going into a 4-to-1 Balun and then to a Millen-Trans match. My question is, based on what I'm reading, let it drop for a second. There is a critical dimension that the feed line has to be odd multiples of quarter wavelengths. Now, since this isn't being cut to any specific frequency, how critical is that? Aesthetically, it's going to be 12 to 16 feet in order to please my wife. That's kind of where I'm stuck at. But how critical is that, and how do I determine what the best dimension is for that 450-ohm line? Basically, what I'm asking is there something obvious I'm missing? Or any input you have would be greatly appreciated. Over to you, Dick.
I think I've got good news for you, Don. Unfortunately, if you tune across 20 meters on almost any day of the week, you'll find somebody on his soapbox propagating a story that everyone has heard it so often. They believe it's the truth. They believe there's a magic length of transmission line, an odd number of quarter wavelengths, an even number of half wavelengths, or whatever, that's going to give them a balanced line by which the bird watt meter is going to read accurately what the real standing wave ratio is, and any of the length of line is not going to read correctly. That's an old wives' tale, but a lot of people believe it. And the radiation of the antenna will only work at certain lengths of line on the feed line. Absolutely not, with rare exception. Let me drop 6 dBs here. They're very fast comments. Okay, now this is one of the sections now where Hal and I do have a disagreement, a technical disagreement. And as you guys know, for the last couple of weeks, John is running a very elaborate experiment to try to confirm or deny. And many people believe there is a magic length of transmission line. At times, Hal has said that, and I disagree with that. Let's see what Hal has to say on this one. K6DPZ, K2LIW. K6DPZ. Well, I'm not going to go there on that discussion. The only thing I wanted to say, if he wants the thing to work, get an auto-tuner, automatic tuner, mount it away from your location, and then feed your 450 ohm line, and your near field will not get into your equipment, because your 50 ohm coax will be going to a tuner that's a distance away. That's my only comment. Gentlemen, have a good evening. K6 Dark Purple Zombie is flying the coop. Okay, yeah. Bye-bye for now, Hal. Glenn, go ahead with your comment, because you fit some fancy antennas with various kinds of open wire line with various kinds of tuners. And what have you discovered along these lines? Over to you, Glenn, K2RIW.
Yeah, good evening, Dick. Just a quick comment about loop antennas. I agree with you completely, Dick. With a loop antenna that's on a single frequency, like 80 meters or something of that nature, and or 40 meters, he was going to use it there. With an antenna tuner, I don't think you'd see any problems. The only time I can say that you could have a problem with certain lengths, like if you reach quarter wavelength at 10 meters and you want it to be use the loop on 10 meters with an antenna tuner, which is kind of common. A lot of guys like to do that. They have a loop antenna and a wire loop, and they like to operate it at on more than just like 80 or 40 meters. They want to go up a little bit higher. And with an antenna tuner and the ladder line, you can do that. But you want to probably avoid quarter wavelengths to some of the other bands that you might want to use, because you might actually start tuning the length of the cable going up instead of the loop itself. It tends to make the antenna tune a little crazy. K2RIW, K2QIQ. It will still match, but it just won't have the right propagation.
I don't think that Don is trying to go up to 10 meters yet on his 200-foot loop. I think he's starting off on the lower bands first. It is my strong belief, Don, that there is no magic length of transmission line. If you're using the transmission line correctly, open wire line doesn't require a Balun at the loop itself, I don't believe. At the transmitting end, it might. You might be starting off with a coax cable coming out of the transmitter, and you'd like to have a nice converter that converts from coax to open wire line.
I'm going to do that.
And say that again, Eric.
Most tuners will be